Hello, and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be reading Siberiad by Lem. Hello, and welcome to History in Reverse. Today, we will be reviewing Siberiad by Lem. My name is Caroline. I'm here today with my father, Richie.
Hello.
And we are back after a bit of a hiatus, just a smidge. How long has it been since we did the last one?
I don't know. At least 6 months. I've meant to check, but I forgot. But do you want to tell us the story? What happened?
What happened? The dog ate our podcast?
The dog ate our podcast.
Oh, because of Sadie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I was watching some friends of mine actually moved overseas and were supposed to bring their dog with them. And there was a bit of a hiccup. She wasn't able to go on the plane. So I was dog sitting and it was supposed to be a short period of time. But then with the pandemic happening and travel being shut down, it ended up being like a 7 month period of time that I was dog sitting. So we weren't able to podcast because I was busy with watching Sadie, but she's a very good girl and she did make it overseas back to her family, which is great. And that's all a happy ending. So now we're back and able to podcast again.
Okay. So this time I think we changed our schedule. I don't even remember what we were planning, but Siberia was one of the things. And since I'm the one who's pushing Lem all the time, and this book is just a collection of short stories, a little bit of an easy read. We just read some selections that were interesting. So just to give you a little background on the book, the book was first published in 1965, and it was actually a sequel.
Oh, there's a first one?
Well, he wrote a collection of stories called Fables of Robots, which were just like almost like children's fables with kings and queens and monsters, but the robots as the character. Siberiad was like the follow-up to that. And Siberiad actually is tales of two constructors, Truel and Klapatsius. It's just how it's, I think it's pronounced.
Oh, is that how you say it? So yep. The first one's Truel. It's for our listeners, it's T-R-U-R-L, Truel.
Right.
And how do you say
Klapatsius? Well, I have the Polish version of the book here, so I can.
I've been saying Klapatsius. That's sure that's incorrect.
Well, in Polish, it's Klapatsius, so it's kind of like Latin-y sounding.
Okay.
Klapatsius. Anyway, so these two constructors who don't appear to be human.
I don't know if it's clear.
It's not clear. I think he kind of implies that they're some kind of artificial beings because they talk about some previous evolutionary step where there was some what they called pale faces or something. Pale watery beings that allegedly, you know, created the spark. You know, there's a creation myth in there somewhere about the. I don't think you read that particular story, but there is one story there about how robots were created. You know, there was some junk on some planet and the thing fell and there was a spark that induced some electricity and so forth and so on. But anyway, so.
Yeah, but it's about these two creators. Actually, it's a good question now. I hadn't really thought about it. I think one of the things about the story that's interesting is Lem goes into a lot of details with the descriptions of the kind of the science fiction ideas and creates a lot of words. And I'm sure with the translation, I can't even imagine what it's like in the original Polish. He creates a lot of words for descriptive purposes, but you don't really have a good image of what the inventors themselves look like.
So the Polish book, actually the English book, if you get the physical book, there's some illustrations in it. And there was an illustrator who kind of tried to show some of these things, but yeah, it's not clear. I think that they're meant to be.
Oh, that's cool. Is there so you read for, I guess we're on a podcast, we probably should describe what we're doing.
Yeah, probably. So yeah, I was showing Caroline some of the pictures in the book. If I remember, I'll include links in the book to some illustrations because they're online.
Yeah, I was gonna say if they're online, we can have people be able to see them. because they're really interesting. Did Lem draw those or somebody else drew them?
No, somebody else drew them. I thought it was Lem, but it's actually, there was an illustrator who did these.
What I think is interesting about these stories, and we're going to get into describing them individually, I think we read 5 or 6 of them total. They're kind of like, they're these little, these kind of short stories where it's like he had like one sci-fi idea. And he was like, let me explore this one sci-fi idea. And instead of like wasting time writing like a whole novel about it, he basically just wrote like a short story about each one and had these inventors around to use as characters to do them. So it kind of ends up being kind of like a slice of life story, but in a science fiction setting, you know?
It's, well, some of the ideas that he has are completely silly, right? So like the very first story, which is called How the World Was Saved, right? Truel builds a machine and the machine can make anything that starts with letter N. Right. So he invites his friend Klapatsius over to show off his machine. He says, ask it to do anything. It just has to start with N. So Klapatsius says, okay, let it make, you know, can you make nothing? And it starts destroying the world. So before they stop it, it destroys a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, Lem says, that's why when you look out in the outer space, there's so much darkness, there's so much nothingness, because this machine destroyed all of this. And now in the story, at the very end, there's like a, he lists things that are no longer there.
Yes. One of the things about the, and this, these stories all, is that Lem's language is so, so interesting. And so, I mean, I think you even made a note of like, you were very impressed by the translation because it's so interesting, even in English, it must've been like, that's the translation from the Polish.
Right.
But he like lists out like the machine that makes anything that starts with N, for example. Most of that story is him listing things that start with N. That
right. Can... And then he makes things up, right? So he's just, right. So the story is kind of silly, but it's, you know, kind of a whimsical. So, and the second story in that kind of vein is the one about Truel's machine, when he builds a machine, and, you know, there's an old tradition of people who build artificial machines that when it, you turn it on and you ask it, what is 2 plus 2? Mm-hmm. So this, he asks this machine, turns it on and says, what is 2 plus 2? The machine says 7. Mm-hmm. And you can't convince it that it's not. And the machine starts arguing with him and kind of just storms off.
Yeah.
And becomes like a monster in an old, like a fairy tale, right? Because...
Isn't that the one that's like chases them?
It chases them into a village and
it chases into the cave. It traps them for a while.
Right.
A lot of people die in that story. Like the village is destroyed. It's like,
yeah, I just listened to a book about retelling of the Greek mythology. It was very similar kind of, and there's like this giant chasing our heroes and trying, but they're running away and hiding from it.
Yeah, exactly.
I forget how they eventually get rid of it. I think it gets stuck in the mountains somewhere.
I know they get stuck in a cave, but that, I read that story a long time ago, so I don't remember specifically how they, I mean, I guess they eventually get out of it because there's more stories after. So right. They survive. But I think this is something that's kind of jumping ahead a bit, is that talking about themes, you know, I love me some themes in literature. One of the things that he plays with in Siberiad is clash and or intersection of, or the combination of kind of classic science fiction ideas with kind of classic fantasy ideas. So like you were just saying with the Greek
fairy mythology. Tales, yeah.
Like fairy tales, that's the perfect way to put it, yeah. Where it's like, you know, they basically were chased by a giant.
Right, exactly.
You know, and they, but
I smell Truel.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it's so interesting to combine those things because those are not things that are normally combined. And I think part, kind of the silliness of some of the stories, like the machine that can make anything that starts with N, is also in that vein in terms of like, because fairy tales are usually like for kids, right? So they're usually kind of sillier. They have like a trick or like an irony in it or some kind of puzzle, which is something we definitely see in the later stories. So the third story, I didn't actually read this one, Trap of Gargadius.
What happened? So the way the book is structured, the first part is a couple of these short stories. And then there's what they call sallies of the two constructors as they travel around the universe and do stuff because they're famous. So they, in this particular one, they land on a planet where there's like two kingdoms that are at war all the time. Mm-hmm. And so one goes to one kingdom, one goes to the other kingdom to advise them. And they essentially, after the you know, neither king wants to have peace. They all like want to basically kill the others or win over the others. So they say, well, we can make a robotic army much, much more powerful if we connect all the robots together, we network them. And so they do that on both ends sides. And when the armies meet, they also connect and network into this huge, huge brain. And all of a sudden, rather than fighting, they want to just talk about philosophy. So that was the gargantuan effect, as they called it. It's like as you connect all these brains together, they don't want to fight, that they want to, you know, contemplate. And that's a kind of very typical Lemish kind of idea.
Yeah. And that's also, it's a very, again, it's kind of has that fairy tale quality of there being like a,
yeah, there's kingdoms and kings fighting.
Yeah. And like the combination of like, it's a kingdom and then here's their robot army.
Right.
Very strange. And I guess I wonder back in like 1965, because like maybe nowadays we have more things that are along those lines, because we have like Star Wars. That's all like robot armies and stuff like that. But back in 1965, I don't think there would have been that much stuff along those lines. Right. I don't know for sure, because I was born in 1991. So I don't know what they were doing back then.
Well, no, there was science fiction, but he, again, he was taking this thing a little bit too extreme, where basically all the characters in it are, you know, robots essentially, or artificial, what we would call artificial life forms, but life forms. But they didn't think that. They, you know, they thought they were just created. You know, there was just some, there's some myths about some, like I said, you know, pale-faced watery creatures or something that allegedly made these things, but nobody really believed it.
Yeah, exactly. No, kind of. But that's silly. Why would you believe that? So then the next one that we read was Truls Electronic Bard, which I really liked. This is a really interesting one. So basically, Trul makes a machine that writes like really awesome poetry. And it ends up causing a bit of a problem, because he makes this machine. At first it writes like bad poetry, it takes him a really long time to make it. And then it writes really good poetry, and then everybody gets upset about it.
Well, even before that, so like the machine, he makes his machine, and of course he wants to show off to his friend. So Klapatsch comes over and he says, you know, give it a challenge, you know, tell it to write a poem, whatever you want. And so he says, okay, write me a poem, you know, about love, but in the language of higher mathematics.
Right.
And there is a poem.
There are a couple of poems in there, and they're so good.
That one, it's like, you know, that begins, you know, come, let us haste into a higher plane, where diet spread, fairy fields of Ben, the indices bedecked from one to end, common gold and endless mark of chain, right? So, and, you know, Trul says, no, don't be so silly, you know, take something else. So he says, okay, why don't you give me a sonnet about a haircut in which every word begins with the letter S, right? And they have it. You know, the guys, I think it begins with the words, silently Samson slept.
Yes.
Right. But what I found interesting about that particular poem, that in the Polish version, that poem is different. It's a different challenge. And it's somewhat politically incorrect. So I'm not going to read it. But I think it's also letter S's.
Is the challenge still to have it start with the same letter? Or is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I am like really amazed at a translator. So basically he had to just come up with this.
You know, I wonder when Lem was writing, if he wrote the story first or if he wrote like some poetry and then wrote a story around it, you know?
Good question.
I could see it either way. What a weird random thing to challenge yourself to write a poem about romance, but through
language of higher mathematics.
Language of higher mathematics, like so strange. Yeah,
but then you know, he asked Klapatsch's name some other crazy thing, and he just throws it out because he said, but the machine just starts spewing this poetry. But then what happens is, right, so Lem, what he likes to do a lot, where he kind of satirizes like academia or governments in the kind of very, I don't know, subtle. This was a little bit more obvious, right? Because the idea was that there were all these human poets, or real poets who heard, it's not clear that they were human, that heard about this machine and went to challenge it, and it would just basically win everything. It's like, you know, they would write a poem, you know, start a poem and tell it a poem, and they would return with the poem that would put the guys to tears, and they would just all win.
Yes. And everybody got, you know, what I find interesting about it though is that because you kind of are dealing with these like very highly creative science fiction concepts of creating a machine that can be like a human brain. He like talks about the process of creating it. And then but the machine stores its poems by printing them out on paper. And it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you wouldn't think of any other way to store it. And of course that's how you would store it. It's kind of like how in Star Trek, there's just no internet. Like that always drives me crazy, because they would have like Facebook on their ship, you know, they'd have ship book.
Oh no, but there's no internet in space, you know, because you have to go far.
No, but even within the ship, you know, like there would be social media with it. People can't help themselves.
Like a meme gen for the spaceship. Yeah.
Right, there would be memes for the spaceship easily, but like they just like don't have anything like that. It just because when Star Trek was originally made, it wasn't something that existed, and so this machine Tool's machine, you know, writes all this wonderful, amazing poetry, and it's this very complicated machine, but needs to store it on paper. It's so weird.
Well, I mean, he has to publish it, right? So,
I guess.
And but he also, when he talks about when he builds the machine, he feeds it all kinds of stuff, right?
Yeah. So I highlighted. I took notes when I read things this time. I know, weird, right? I highlighted a quote, kind of the passage about making the machine. And about like, where do you start in terms of creating a machine to mimic not only a human brain, but a poet's brain and like the process of poetry. And so part of what he wrote was, the program found in the head of an average poet, after all, was written by the poet's civilization. And that civilization was in turn programmed by the civilization that preceded it, and so on to the very dawn of time, when those bits of information that concerned the poet to be we're still swirling about in the primordial chaos of the cosmic deep.
Right. That's very deep. Great.
That's like really great, because it's like, it's such a concise way to talk about like poetry as it is, you know. I'm writing too, I guess, in a broader sense, but poetry especially is so referential to the poet's feelings and understandings and point of view. And that's based on their world's experience and their civilization, which is based on the previous one. And it really does kind of embody all of human history into a single poem.
Right.
Every poem is that way. And I was just like, wow, okay, Lem, I see you. I see you making some philosophical points here in the middle of this chapter in one sentence. I got it. So I thought that was really interesting.
That's actually a theme that kind of occurs and feel that actually another story in this book, which we didn't read, I read some of it. Well, let me just say that I've read this book first when I was like 12, I think. So I had reread it many times since then, and in Polish and in English. Mm. So there's, Lem has this, later on there's a story about one of the constructors trying to find the most advanced civilization in the universe.
Mm.
And there's some theories how you find it and stuff. So he actually finds it. And when he lands there, he discovers that the beings in that civilization, all they do around is just sit around and pick their noses.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, we are the top civilization. What else is up for us to do? If we do anything, it's just going to be bad, or it's going to bring us down from the top. So we'll just
pick it.
and they don't want to talk with him. So they send him away so far away that he can't come back. So instead, he builds a simulation where he feeds all the history and civilization that came before to create a simulation of his civilization so that he can discuss with the beings, with the simulated beings in there. You know, it's, you know, that kind of thing. So, but that theme occurs in his writing and a number of places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, and in the other story you were just talking about as well, with the connecting the brains and stuff like that, with the concept of connections between people, is whether it be like on the individual level, because I think there's a strong theme of friendship throughout these stories, which we'll talk about after we go over the plots of each. And but not just a relationship between individuals in a microcosm, but also in the macro kind of sense, like when and over aeons, right? Like over time and across space and stuff like that, which is really, really interesting and makes the stories just fascinating to read. And the other, one of the other quotes I highlighted from this poet one was, he goes on this long paragraph, I won't read the whole thing, about how he built this machine. And he like makes up all these things about like the electrostatic spirit and the protogalactic cloud and all these things that he's doing to make this machine, whatever. He's doing all this, you know, fake science fiction mumbo jumbo. And then he ends the paragraph with, "And if anyone questions these figures, let him work it out for himself." Which is such like a great like science fiction hand wave of like, and if you try to think too hard about it, well, good luck. Which I thought was great.
What happened to the machine at the end?
The poetry machine, they end up putting, don't they put it on the planet somewhere? And then somebody else picks it up and it leads to like nuclear war somewhere far away in the galaxy. That's what as far as I recall.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember what they did.
They don't keep the poetry machine. They put it, everyone gets really mad at it. So they're forced
I mean, everybody gets really mad at it. So
they're forced to abandon it and it gets picked up by some other civilization for a while. And then there's like kind of these distant reports that there's like nuclear war or something far away. And they're like, ooh, yikes. And then the story ends. So then, do you have anything else on that one, or do you want to move on to the next one?
Let's move on to the next one.
So the next one is The Mischief of King Beleriand. Now, first things first, I don't know if you know this, Beleriand is the name of the biggest, most powerful dragon in A Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh, really? So they stole from here.
Beleriand the Black Dread, that Aegon the Conqueror rode to conquer all of Westeros and unite the Seven Kingdoms, a dragon that lived for like, gosh, 150 years or something. It's like very old, like one of the oldest dragons. He was like huge and black and scary and all this stuff. And so then I start reading the story and it's like King Beleriand. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. So yeah, this next story is about a king that likes to play games.
Right. He was a fun guy. He liked to play games. And who was it? Trull or Clapatius Landic? Trull, I think.
Trull. Trull's always the one starting trouble. Clapatius is always showing up later and cleaning up the mess.
Right. So Trull lands there and he says, "I have this great toy for you. You can..." Oh, he liked to play hide and seek, right?
Yes. So the king, like King Beleriand, liked to play different games. He especially liked to play hide and seek. And he put out a challenge that the person that could show him the greatest hiding spot would win this like ancient crown. And there's some details in the story that the king would sometimes would hide for days and people couldn't find him and the whole court would be in disarray because they couldn't find the king. So Trull shows up with an invention to show the king the greatest hiding spot. Do you remember what the invention was?
Yeah, so this was some kind of a little thing you put on your head that looked like horns. And if you tapped somebody's head with it, you swapped minds with the other person. So you could essentially hide in the other person's. So Trull explained it to him and Beleriand put it on his head and bumped Trull. And then Trull /Beleriand just ran away.
Right.
and Trull, before he knew what was happening, he was sitting there as the king.
Then shenanigans ensued.
Right. So, of course, he didn't do it just once. He did it many times. So after a while, he had no idea where the hell the mind of the king was. And actually, Clapatius came, right, to...
Yeah, Clapatius was already there.
He was already there?
Yeah, oh, this is the one where they went together. They went together and they tried to see the king one day, but they couldn't. So they stayed in like an inn and then they went back to the castle and they met the king together. So Clopas just watched this happen. So he knew what was going on already. He didn't have to come and be here to fix it.
Right.
He already knew he had to fix it.
Right. So he just had to, when Trull ran out, he went up, ran after him, trying to, catch him before anything else happened. And
right.
He had to actually come up with it, kind of follow where the king was.
Right. And the king goes from, he goes through several bodies, but he eventually ends up in the body of a policeman, like a captain of the guard or whatever it is. Right. And locks Clopatius up. And then Clopatius has to trick him to get out. And it's all rather confusing because there's like a lot of body swapping happening.
Right.
But they do eventually get all the bodies swapped appropriately.
Almost.
Some of the people never get returned to their bodies. And I'm like, these poor guys. There's like the actual original policeman is in like a sailor's body and nobody ever like finds him and fixes it or tells him what happened.
Right.
And the king ends up, so the king's body ends up being inhabited by the sailor, the good sailor. So they have a better king.
He was a good guy, nice guy.
Yeah, he seemed like a nice dude. So we'll put him in the king's body. It's fine. That should be okay. And then the king's mind, they figured out that they could transfer minds into inanimate objects. So the king's mind was put into a cuckoo clock.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. He was like doomed to forever be a clock. And then Trull and Clopatia just take the crown and leave.
Right.
Because they're like, we gave him the best hiding spot. He's a clock.
Nobody will find him.
Exactly. Very funny. Oh, let me see if I have any highlights from.
That story seems slightly familiar, though, like that kind of a silly game. I was trying to think if there were other stories or myths or something that were along those lines.
I mean, there's lots of kids' stories like that. So, body swap problems are very, very common in like basically any serialized television show. I think basically every television show.
There was a couple of movies, right?
There are movies about it. I mean, but like literally basically every television show has one. The one show that doesn't have a body swap episode, I think, is Supernatural, which somehow went like 15 seasons without having a body swap episode. And quite a lot of the fandom wanted there to be a body swap episode from whatever call, but there never actually was one. But it's a very, I mean, Star Trek had body swap.
Right, right.
Constant, like every Star Trek had a body swap. It's a common problem. And it's kind of like, you know, when you have a shape-shifting alien who can look like you, you know, that's also like a very, it's just kind of like a trope.
Right.
But okay. I think what's interesting is in most body swap stories, everyone's ultimately returned to their proper place. But in this one, they're not. Trull and Clopatius like purposefully move. They return themselves. They're like very concerned about returning themselves, but they're not particularly concerned about returning other people.
So well, they have no idea who's where for that matter, because the king was going a little bit bananas there.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just like, it's kind of interesting because I mean, they're our main characters, but I don't know that they necessarily have the characteristics of like heroes exactly. They're not exactly like, you know, there for the common good. They're kind of there to like mess around and see what they can do.
Yeah, mess around. And, you know, they get money or they get paid for their services by the great constructors who are known throughout the universe.
Exactly. But the last one that we read was How Trull's Perfection Led to No Good, which is this the story that inspired SimCity?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. You want to tell it?
Right. So what happens was Trull is traveling through some space and he sees this little planet and there's like seems to be somebody on it. So he lands and it turns out it's a king. And the king was put in exile because I guess his subject did not like him. And so he's alone on this planet, kind of sad. So Trull says, well, you know, I'm a big constructor. I can do lots of stuff. So you won't be so sad and you want to be a king. I'll make you a little kingdom like in a box. So he built a little kingdom in a box and he gave it to the king. And he says, here, you can play with it. And, you know, the king was known to be cruel, which is why he was in exile. So he comes back home and he has lunch with his friend, Clopatius, and he says, look at the nice thing I did. You know, I gave him and Clopatius says, oh my God, how could you do such a horrible thing? He says, wow, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And then there's a whole big discussion about, says, you are a great constructor. He says, well, yes, I am. And you build perfect things. Yes, I do. And so the little subjects that you build for the king, are they going to suffer when they're, you know, tortured by this king? And he says, rah, rah, rah.
Yeah.
And there's like kind of whole discussion about, you know, what does it mean to suffer? You know, it's and I guess whether an artificial being could suffer. And
right, exactly. And what does it mean to be alive? Because this the kingdom he builds is like very, very detailed. It's miniature, but it's like
right. He's a wonderful constructor, right? So
yeah, exactly.
He's perfect.
Like it's very detailed. I was sort of asking the question, not only can artificial intelligence suffer, but is artificial intelligence alive? Is it not the same as us?
Right.
And so basically the story has a little beginning part about the king, then like a philosophy essay in the middle, and then the ending.
And then they go back saying, so Truls says, oh my God, what have I done? So let's go back. So they go back, and when they get to the planet is covered with tiny little cities and mm-hmm. stuff, and they even see little nuclear explosions here and there, and they bump into something in orbit. They're thinking it's a moon. Turns out it's the body of the king.
Yep.
And the original box is like a temple or something.
Yeah, I thought that was such an interesting detail, that the original box that he had them in, because it had like a glass lid. So the glass lid was still there, but it was like broken, and it was like a temple that they had preserved, and the little people had spread all over. It was like an asteroid or something that they were on. Like what I find really interesting about that story is this happens sometimes in stories where the opening is a foreshadow to the end, because the king is found. Truel finds him on this asteroid abandoned because his people rejected him and threw him out. And then at the end, he's found abandoned.
And rejected.
More dead, but abandoned because his people rejected him and threw him out. So it's sort of an interesting cycle. And I like that kind of book ending for the story. It's really, really nice. Like, it makes a really nice little story. But it's like definitely very, very philosophical. So that inspired SimCity, like actually?
Yeah, actually, yes.
That's
the original SimCity authors were inspired by, got the idea from this story.
Wow. The hours of my life I spent playing SimCity and all the related Sim games. Thank you, Lem. That's off to you, Lem. So, okay, those are the stories. We kind of ran through their plots so that we could talk about overarching themes and concepts. And we sort of started to touch on a few things. But you're rereading these stories now. So what do they feel like to you now, having read them, as opposed to when you were younger reading them?
So this time when I was reading them again, that they seemed a little bit tedious, like with all this language that seems a little bit overboard. It's mm-hmm. like sometimes you want to say, okay, yeah, I understand, you can make up words. Let's get to the point. Mm-hmm. And you know, he makes up words and names like for the princesses and kings, and I think it's on purpose just to kind of have a contrast between the concepts of old fairy tales and this very science fiction-y robots and stuff. But I found it a little bit tedious. So like I was reading later on, there's a story about, well, there's like a story within a story within a story within a story,
mm-hmm.
because I think Truel Klapatius goes to some king to make them, he made a machine for him to tell stories. And the mm-hmm. machine tells stories about another king who had machines made to have dreams. Mm-hmm. So he could have great dreams, and they described dreams, and he doesn't like this dream, so they have another dream. And eventually they have like a recursive dream machine, because nobody can stand this king, and they just put them as a machine. And he goes so deeply into nested dreams that he doesn't know whether he's in or out.
So Lem also wrote Inception in 1965,
right,
and we didn't realize it.
So there's that. But so this is like one long story, but it's really like five or six different stories in one, because, you know, the one about the most advanced civilization, that mm-hmm. kind of harks back a little bit to the machine that does poetry, where he has to build a simulation to have a conversation with those people.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the pacing, what you're identifying in terms of it being tedious is a pacing issue. I think some of the pacing, I think, was a little bit slow, even for a short story. And particularly with a short story, you have even less space to do anything. I was really happy, actually, though, with the last story, the Truel's Perfection, with the little asteroid civilization, because it really does just kind of stop in the middle, and they kind of have a philosophical debate back and forth. But I didn't find that to be too long. I thought that was a good length.
Right.
Allowed the characters to interact. So then, you know, this is my first time reading them. As I said before, it's sort of these sort of slice of life science fiction stories, which is something strange. Like slice of life stories are usually about, you know, but they're kind of more traditionally about regular people. They're like fictional, but in like within, right. set within our universe kind of thing. it's kind of interesting to see it. I don't know if slice of life is exactly the right word to describe it, but that's the best I can think of.
Well, there's like an interesting juxtaposition of levels, right? So like you have a machine that writes poetry, right? Okay. But then you feed it like all the information about cosmic civilization from the very inception of the world, you know? Oh, you have a king who likes to play hide and seek, and then you have this mind talking thing happening, and it becomes like a little detective story. So it's like there's some very low level things, but some very cosmic things, you know?
Yeah. And I like that. I like the combination of those two things. That's sort of reflective of the combination of traditional fairy tales and science fiction.
Right.
And, you know, those two genres being so very different, fairy tales being very, very old and science fiction being relatively new in human history.
Right. Fairy tales also tend to have morals, right? And so these stories don't quite have a moral. Don't build a machine that writes poetry so bad that people get upset, right?
Exactly. It's like, does it? I think that's kind of what I was identifying before, was that the characters themselves, so when we talk about them for a bit, Trull and Clopatius, they don't have, they're not heroes. They don't have the characteristics that we would imagine for a hero, right? Like in a fairy tale, they're not like necessarily brave. They're not particularly like selfless. Like they're these great inventors, and what are they spending their time doing? You know, building machines that can write poetry. They're not like building machines to end like hunger in the universe or something like that, or cure all diseases. They're kind of just messing around and trying to show off to each other all the time.
Well, they also doing jobs for people, right? So,
yeah, which is like, you know, kind of neither here nor there, I think. But it's sort of interesting that it is sort of a fairy tale like feel to it. But I don't think we have heroes in the role that would normally be the hero role in the fairy tale.
They're more like the bumbling guys who kind of stumble along. I mean, these fantastic constructors, right? They can make all this stuff, but they just kind of stumble into things.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they're, you know, in lots of fairy tales have these have these kinds of characters, though. Like, you know, there's like the three brothers, and the older ones are like bumbling idiots, and the youngest one is the nicest one of them all, but he's not the sharpest tool in the box or something, or not brightest pixel on the screen. No.
Yeah. I suppose so. And I think another thing that's interesting about Trull and Clopatius is how much they spend. So one of the things that's throughout these stories is that they spend so much time trying to one-up each other.
Yeah.
Just constantly. And they have this great, I think it's one of the themes that comes through the story, is like the theme of friendship and the theme of, we were talking about before, connections between people. The first example being the one between Trull and Clopatius, and their friendship. They're working together. They're constantly saving each other. To the extent that either of them show any amount of bravery, it is in saving one another.
Right.
But mostly their conversations are them trying to show off to one another.
Right. Right.
And which is, it's adorable, kind of, but
yeah, it says, oh, look, I did this wonderful thing. He says, oh my God, how could you have done it?
Right, exactly. Or like, look at how great my machine is. And the other one says, it's not so great. Your machine's not so great. And, you know, they like the kind of competition between them is very different, I think, from something you would see in like a fairy tale or a fantasy kind of story, that your main characters are like that. And yet they're still very good friends. So I think friendship is definitely a theme throughout the stories. You know, they're running from danger together. They're saving each other. And not only like physical danger, but they're keeping each other like in moral check. Like in the last story, where Trull says, I made this wonderful little kingdom for this evil dictator. And Clopatius says, you're crazy. Go back and fix it. That's the bad thing to do.
Right. You
know, they're keeping each other in line in that way as well, which I think is really interesting. Because we don't get a lot of characterization of them throughout. So I think that's definitely a theme.
And so I guess maybe that's the latest stories in the book, which I was reading and I kind of got bogged down in, is because they kind of disappear. You know, it's like Clopatius goes to some kingdom and brings a machine that tells stories. And then you hear the stories the machine tells.
Mm-hmm.
And so he and Trull kind of out of the way. Similarly with the one when they look for civilization that is most advanced, It's also like Kapatsis, I think, figures it out, finds the place and talks to the people for 5 minutes. They send them away. And then he builds a machine to simulate the entire universe again to that point, and then he can talk to them because there's simulations.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, these stories, the point is not Clapacious and Truel. I think the point is the cool science fiction idea, right, and Clapacious and Truel are the vessels through which that story is told, right, you know, as opposed to coming up with a new main characters every single time and having to explain new ones for every single story. Lem just made a pair and was able to utilize them for these stories, which is fine. Not every story.
Well, he's got a couple other sequences of writing where he has a character that gets carried through.
And that's fine. That's a perfectly legitimate way to do it. And I think while the stories and the text are not particularly focused on the characterization of these two guys, through watching them do different things and through seeing their reactions to things and how they do stuff, the characterization builds over time through the stories, which is interesting. It's not something you see a lot.
Well, again, like the other sequence of stories he has is Pilot Perks. It starts, the first couple of stories about him are very kind of lightweight and kind of, they're not quite as crazy as these. They're like the regular about a cadet basically who's training to be a pilot in space and et cetera, et cetera. And then it goes, Perks appears in the very last novel that Lem wrote, which was this novel, first contact novel called Fiasco, which one day I hope you'll read because there's a whole bunch of stuff in it that you need to explain to me.
Oh, okay.
No, because there's like some novels within novels. Anyway, so...
Does somebody sit down and read a book with an old man in a park
bench? Well, they do that too, but there's a guy who tells a story that is completely like, I don't know what this has to do with this story.
I mean, but it's Lem. It could mean nothing. There's a very solid chance that it doesn't have anything to do with the story.
So the Perks is one. And then the other one is that he's got another character named Ion Tihe, who's like in between. So he's not quite as crazy as these two guys, but it's very satirical. So lots of his stuff is very satirical.
Right. So that satire comes up in this one as well. That's always kind of his thing.
This one didn't have quite as much of it, a little bit like in the Gargantuan effect, where he pokes fun at governments. And, you know, you have to remember that 1965, he lived in Poland, which was communist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to get stuff published, you had to get past censors. And so he was very clever about that he thinks kind of indirectly kind of, not so much in these stories and Ion Tihe's stories.
But these stories too, I wonder if that's one of the reasons why his characters are always like they're kings, right? Because there were that's different. That's a different kind of government. You know, I wonder if that was one of the driving motivations. He couldn't say like, you know.
Well, part of it was, you know, fairy tales often have kings and princesses and princes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. I mean, I wonder, you know, it's chicken and the egg kind of thing. Like, which one came first? Was it that he wanted? Because, I mean, he does, these stories do kind of comment on some different governments.
Right.
And, you know, whether it's right to have a king who's evil and give him a kingdom. You know, whether it's right to kind of subvert who the king is and pretend he, you know, just replace him with someone else and pretend it's fine.
Replace him with somebody who's sane or who's right. Reasonable as opposed to somebody who just wants to play.
Right. And it's like that probably wouldn't have gone over as well if it was not kind of shrouded in the fantasy kind of, which is very interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So in terms of themes, talk about friendship, ironing, satire, we've talked a lot already about the intersection of science fiction and fantasy and that kind of juxtaposition, which is definitely prevalent here. Do we have any other themes? I can't think of any other particular themes. Those are all strong themes, those four throughout.
No, I guess so.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about, just based on these stories that we read, is are there any women in these stories?
Well, there are princesses here and there, but you haven't read these, but I'll tell you what the title is of some of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of stories called Sifra Eroticon, or Tales of Deviation, Superfixations, Aberrations of the Heart. You know, Prince Felix and Princess Crystal. So there were some love stories in some of the stories within stories. So only you know, in the later stories, there were some things about princesses. The fourth Sally, or how Truel's builder Femme Fatalatron to save Prince Pantagon from pangs of love. And I read that and I don't remember now what happened, but it was like there's some prince that fell in love with somebody he wasn't supposed to. So they hired Trull to undo it and fun ensued.
Yeah. So the reason I bring this up is because we read Solaris, which was by Lem as well, right? And I love Solaris, one of my favorites. Solaris also had some female characters that were problematic, and pretty much to the extent that, which is very common, that the female character was present strictly for like the romantic aspect, that she didn't really have any characterization beyond that, including in Solaris that she wasn't a real person. She was an expression of the ocean, which is a whole other issue with Solaris. But in these stories, I found exactly one quote that talked about women. Uh-huh. And it was from the last story where he was creating the little fake kingdom in the simulated kingdom in the box.
Right.
And he was definitely making last minute adjustments with his microscopic tools as it ran. And he gave the women of that kingdom beauty, and the men sullen silence and surliness, the officials arrogance and servility, the astronomers an enthusiasm for the stars, and the children a great capacity for noise. So for all women, he gave them beauty. And then he breaks down like all these other people that are assumed to be men. They're all the men this, the officials this, the astronomers this, like all these other people. And I mean, it was 1965.
You jump into conclusions just because astronomers, that doesn't, you know, imply that they weren't beautiful astronomers.
I think the way it's written, it pretty much implies that the rest of those are men. But I mean, I guess you could read it and interpret it the other way. But the lack of women throughout is like really astounding to me, how there's just like not even side characters.
He doesn't have women characters in his stuff. So like, for example, from the Solaris era, there's another book that I really like, very hard science fiction called The Invincible. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a ship full of men lands on a planet to find another ship that was lost on that planet. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's all like guys. This is all like 1960s.
It's all dudes being bros.
Guys, you know, being macho on this. So there's that. There's another one from that same era. It's called Eden. And in that one, the characters don't even have names. So he calls them the doctor, the engineer, the captain, you know. Uh-huh. And that's how he refers to them to write the book.
Uh-huh.
So
it's sort of interesting because I brought this up to you before we podcasted, and I don't know that you entirely agree with me, but the stories in Siberia, mm-hmm. for their severe lack of female characters, ends up having probably an accidental kind of LGBT vibe to them. And I don't know, I am sure it was accidental. I don't think Lem intended it, but as a reader in 2021, there are a handful of instances where Trull and Cloplacius do things, and I'm like, you're like really good friends? Like, what's happening? So they reference, first of all, they're always traveling together. They're saving each other. You know, they're doing the, you know, best friend kind of stuff. They stay at an inn together.
No wives.
What?
No wives.
They have no wives. There's no women around. They can't, right. There's nobody else. They're always going and seeing each other. And then there's like other weird interactions. Like in one of the stories, Trull is unconscious, he's in a coma. And Cloplacius shows up and is like, oh, I can wake him up. Hold on, I have the quote. So Cloplacius shows up and he's like, oh, I can wake him up from this coma that he's in because you drugged him to be unconscious. And Cloplacius comes upon Trill in the bed and he says, well acquainted with his friend's habits and peculiarities, Cloplacius touched the heel of Trill's foot, and Trull jumped up instantly wide awake, for he was exceedingly ticklish.
I didn't think of it that way, but, you know, I'll give you that.
When was the last time you tickled somebody's foot? When was the last time, I asked my listeners too, when was the last time you tickled somebody's foot? When was the last time you knew your good friend's ticklish spot? And then there's another line. sorry, I'm trying to find it. There's another line from the first, from the, or no, from the poet story, where Clopatius shows up and Trul sees him and is like up in the machine, and he runs down to see Clopatius, and it says, laughed Trul, racing down the metal stairs and flinging himself delightedly into his colleague's arms. Okay. I see you being bros. I see you.
Well, I mean, tell the male or female?
What?
How do you know if the male or female?
Trul and Clopatius?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good question. If they're not human.
See, in Poland,
yeah, gender's a construct anyway. So, like, you know.
Right, yeah. It's so interesting because I know.
But you know, they're identified in the stories as men, and with the his pronouns, so they're all referred to as men. But yeah, maybe they're not. Maybe they're aliens, and who knows?
Well, they're machines, right? So
yeah. So, but it's sort of interesting because it's like once you can think about it, if you had like that passage of, you know, a character A running down the stairs and flinging themselves into the arms of character B. If that was a man and a woman, that would be really obviously romantic, right? That would be like really obviously something that would catch the reader. But it kind of just like kind of slips by in these stories. But those kind of details are all over the place.
Right. So one of the things about these stories. So back when I was a poor Polish child, and I learned how to read, one of my favorite things to read was fairy tales. And my mother was a teacher, and she had access to the school library in her school, so she would take books out and bring them for me. So I got to read like tons and tons of fairy tales from like all around the world, and a lot of them have that kind of similar vibe to these stories, where there were characters who were sometimes whether two men or two girls or whatever, often brothers who would, you know, do stuff together, you know. And back in the olden days, you know, before people had separate rooms, people would sleep in the same bed and stuff. So that's part of the, I think that's my explanation.
That very well could be it. I don't think that Lem was in 1965 trying to have, you know, LGBT representation in his science fiction short stories. I don't think that. But that reading is definitely present. And
that's interesting.
A lot of times what the audience takes away from it is not necessarily what the author intended, and that can be good or bad. And, you know, intention is one thing and actual effect is another. So it's just sort of interesting to see that the ability to have that reading from like legitimate passages in the text and not like crazy town like readings of it. Like some people interpret some Shakespeare stuff as gay, and it's like not, it's just kind of crazy town interpretations of it. Though some Shakespeare stuff is very gay, so it just depends on which play you're talking
about. Well, I mean, like I said, I just read a book about the Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of gayness was just normal. It wasn't no big deal. And Heracles had a wife and children, a couple of wives, some boyfriends.
So it's sort of interesting to see that in these stories.
Right.
And last thing I was thinking we could talk about, because we've read some other Lem, because someone here has chosen some other Lem for us to read before.
Mm-hmm.
So how do these compare? We read for the podcast, we read Solaris. Did we read any other Lem?
I don't think so.
What about, was Return from the Stars Lem?
Oh yeah, of course. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we read Solaris and we read Return from the Stars. So how do these compare to those? Those were novels, obviously. So there's a difference in length. But do we see patterns or anything interesting in comparing them?
Well, in Return of the Stars, there's bits about artificial life, especially that really creepy scene in the junkyard of robots, right?
Ooh, yeah. Ooh. That was a very creepy scene. I liked it, but I didn't like it. It was very creepy.
It was very creepy. And again, that's a theme that occurs throughout Lem. Here, there wasn't that much of that kind of stuff, except it was all robots. So,
yeah.
And then, you know, women characters, as you pointed out, you know, even the woman character in Return from the Stars was just kind of kind of Limp Bizkit, basically.
Yeah, she was just kind of the vessel through which our main character kind of got like walked around the city, basically.
Yeah.
So I guess yeah, there's some a lack of female characters in the stories. I wonder why that is. I wonder. I guess maybe then it just he didn't think of scientists as women, and so he was writing about scientists, so there just weren't female characters.
Well, I mean, he was right again. He was writing about manly men who went into space and returned from the stars, and similarly in Solaris, manly men going, not so much manly men, but you know, men going to the space station to, you're right, be scientists. So that women are kind of went not part of it.
Well, sort of interesting because in Solaris, the female character was sort of a monster to the male character and sort of terrorized.
Unintentional, right? It was just.
Well, yeah, she sort of terrorized him in a lot of ways. So she was the most prominent female character I can think of for what I've read of Lem. The one who returned from the stars just like is kind of just around for a bit, but disappears after a while.
Yeah, she's just there to be, you know, the object of his affection. Just you don't really know much about her. She just kind of.
In Return from the Stars, he went that main character went to space in that, and that was a ship full of men, right?
Yeah, and they came back 200 years in the future, right? So,
Wait, but how many years was he did he actually experience that? I don't remember.
just a couple of years.
So it's interesting. But you can definitely see themes about artificial life. Solaris, I mean, Solaris's big thing is about kind of asking what is life and how do you talk to it.
Right.
So I guess that similar theme of what makes something alive comes out in Solaris. And Solaris asks that question and does not answer
Right.
it.
Well, regarding artificial life, so like in Aeon Tihi's stories, there are some couple of silly stories where he goes to an insane asylum for robots.
Right.
Right. So it's similar to the robots being broken. So where robots says, some robot stops him and says, "Listen, shh, I'm not a robot. Just glue stuff on me."
Yes, and then Futurama riffed off of that and did an episode of it.
Well, that was another story that was also in the same cycle, where the hero goes, is sent as a spy to spy on this planet of robots. So they dress him up as a robot in disguise, and turns out everybody there is in disguise. So there are no robots there at all. And that's for Futurama, kind of ripped that off.
Right, do we have any other thoughts on Siberia?
No, my last thought is that I guess after many times I have read it, this kind of hasn't aged as well as some of the other stories.
I mean, as reading it for the first time now, I didn't think it read too old. I think it didn't read modern exactly, but it didn't read like I didn't know it was in 1965. I wouldn't have guessed it was that old. I would have guessed it was pre-2000s, but not. I wouldn't have thought it was that old.
But maybe I'm getting too impatient in my old age.
I just like the ideas are interesting. And you know what, you kind of see a similar kind of slice of life science fiction thing with Ted Chiang. We both love Ted Chiang and his short stories, and it's the same kind of thing. He has like one, well, he kind of, but he, so he's kind of interesting. He's like the advanced version of this because he has like one science fiction concept, but then his short story is a little bit longer, but they have a little bit more oomph to them. And he always makes it, or usually makes it into some kind of social commentary that you can pretty much put your finger on. So like, for the podcast, we did some of his stories, right? So we did the one where you have the implant in your eye and it records
Right.
everything.
Right.
And that also cut back and forth with the history of the one of the tribe learning writing.
Yes,
And
yeah.
that's like a one science, there's one science fiction concept in that. Drew that out into like a much broader kind of social commentary and thicker, denser story. Same thing with the story of your life. That was one science fiction concept that he destroyed my brain with. So I guess it's sort of interesting to see how these things develop over time and as new
You
science
need
fiction
to read the
writers.
second collection of his stories.
Yeah. Well, so what are we going to read next?
So are we going to attempt Dune?
I think we should do Dune. I think you were suggesting doing it in parts because it's so big.
Yes. Yes.
So I think that that would make sense. Because when's the Dune movie coming out? I know it got pushed back again.
End of this year, maybe.
Eventually, sometime. So I think it's a good time to reread that. And
I think there's like Dune is divided into 3 or 4 books. So let's do book one for next time.
Yeah. So I have my shiny new Kindle, so I can read anything, in theory, on my shiny new Kindle.
I still have some notes from it. I was listening to the audio version. It was really, really good. So, So I might want to listen to it again.
Yeah, so we can do, so then we can do the first book of Dune, and man, talk about themes and characterization. I'm going to have a field day. My notes are going to be like 10 pages long. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening to History in Reverse. I hope you enjoyed our podcast and we'll see you next time.
Okay.
Bye. Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we'll be reading Siberiad by Lem. Did Zoom pick up the diddle-a-doo that my computer did?
Yeah.
It picked up the sound from my computer?
Yeah, I heard that. So I'm sure it recorded.
Okay, so let me redo it. Let me do it again.
Take two.